teaching or studying or whatever, you might sort of find me in the XMPP community. And well, we're working on a XMPP server called Prosody, and that contains some C bindings, so we do the C bindings. And I'm working with some other people on an Objective-C XMPP library, which noteworthy is not based on Cocoa, so it's actually affordable. Also being an electrical engineering student, and obviously all the programming work you sort of get to do is quite close to hardware, so it involves a lot of getting to know C. So that's maybe my motivation for doing this talk. Okay, so what are we talking about? So disclaimer, what are we talking about? We're not talking about. I'm going to talk about C99, so it's a revision SSD standard which was published in 1999. And everything that we'll talk about will also apply to C2011, which was published in December last year. What we're not going to talk about is C++. That's a separate standard, different rules apply, apparently completely different rules in some cases. I'm not fully aware of them because I don't do a lot of C++. We are going to talk about Objective-C in some sense, because while we're not going to cover any objective aspects of Objective-C, it is a real superset. So everything that applies to C99, if you compile Objective-C into C99 mode, it will apply again. Okay, so quick overview. We're going to start out talking about undefined behavior, what that is exactly. Then we're going to talk about the strict aliasing rule, which some of you might know, a lot of you might not know. It's actually a special case of undefined behavior, but it's not worth it to make it separate. Now we're going to talk about arrays, and you're all thinking, why are we talking about arrays? It's completely boring, but I hope it's not going to be. We're going to talk specifically about multidimensional arrays, because I get the feeling that some people are confused about them in some cases. Then we're talking about different conversion rules in C, which also some people tend to confuse, and they're actually somewhat hard if you want to get all of them in your head. That would be what happens when I add two numbers of completely different types and what's cast to what and all that sense. And then we're going to, well, have some fun with C99. So basically, what you see in C99 that's actually fun and interesting to use above and C. Okay, so undefined behavior. Well, what did that? The C standards defines multiple types of behavior. This is implementation defined behavior, which is implementation defined, so each compiler makes its own choice, and it says 70% should be documented. So your compiler does something, puts into the implementation, watches the exact behavior we are doing, and then that happens. There's unspecified behavior, where the C standard guarantees you that one thing out of a set of things will happen. And then there's undefined behavior. And undefined behavior is what we're going to talk about here. And basically means there are no rules enforced by a standard for this specific case. Which means anything may happen. The evil example that no compiler will actually implement, obviously, is well, he might format your C drive because you invoke undefined behavior. Any program that contains such behavior is irrelevant. And we're going to see some examples of what you need to do to invoke undefined behavior when your compiler may format your C drive or not. Basically, the thing is, you can do anything from assuming a warning, assuming an error, or just compile a program and something strange happens at runtime. So, as a sort of motivation to set breakdown of intuition, I have this "Who Wants to Be a Millionaire" type of questions for you, just to see whether you actually know what you think you're doing. So, let's say we have some snippet of C code, right? And the question is, what does it usually print if you don't optimize it and you're in x86? So let me talk about a bit about the snippet. We have an unsigned integer with 32-bit width, and it's assigned a 1. Then it's, well, shifted by 32-bit, and then we print it. And that's actually something apparently people don't know, and it's interesting to me they don't. The C standard nicely defines for us ways to print this fixed with integer types. Basically, what this macro is, it's just a define for another string with any string concatenations. So you don't have to guess is it percent I or is it just percent LI, you just use this macro and you're fine. So, okay, what would any of you think? You think this prints a zero. Okay, so who would think this prints a one? I'd say that's less. Who thinks this prints a 42? Okay, and neither? Okay, so the correct, in some way, answer in this case is one. So, just to guess the proof for this, who has an idea why this prints one, without saying what it is, but who has an idea why this might be one? Please raise your hand.
Yeah, you may only shift by 31. 32 is 1.
Okay, so, well, I'm going to give you the, you may only shift by 31, that's correct. The thing is, why this is happening, why did they actually do it like this? It's interesting because this is different among platforms. If you're using a 32-bit x86 system and even a 64-bit x86 system, for 32-bit types, so if you map to sender, for 32-bit registers, the shift basically has a certain space it allocates for the shift amount, and that's 5 bits. And 5 bits can contain numbers up to 31. So if you specify 32, you encode it as an integer, cut off the last 5 bits, use that, and that's all zeros. So you shift to 1 by an amount of 0. If you do the same thing on a power PC, the results are actually 0, because they have 6 bits for the same purpose. So the 1 is included, and you get 0s. So this is the typical case for why is a good undefined behavior in the C-standard. Because, of course, you can special case, sort of thing like, okay, if the user has something more than 32, let me just set it to 0 hard with a mod instead of a left shift left, logical shift left. But that's just unperforming, and you don't really want that. So the rules, so this is quoted for the left shift left operand. If the value of the right operand, so that's the shift amount, is negative or is greater than or equal to the width of the criminal left operand, the behavior is undefined. So that's what happens there. It's 1 even though you probably expect 0, and it might be 0 on a different platform. And if you're on a 64-bit system, maybe he didn't use enough space to actually be able to shift up to 64. Maybe he didn't. If you optimize it on a 64-bit system, it's actually 0, because then he uses RAX instead of EAX. With all those different, interesting kind of behaviors you can now get out there if you just compile it differently. So don't use it. I mean, in the end, it's the same thing as setting it to 0 if you were doing it on purpose, and you probably just weren't doing it on purpose anyway. So, different question. This is about integers overflow. So someone worked this, in his opinion, very clever code to check, okay, I want to allocate a buffer for a string, and the string is n characters long, so I need a byte for the 0 character. So I allocate n plus 1, and now I need to check somehow, does that overflow if I add the 1 to the size the user gave me? So presume we have this code, and we have this check where he aborts if it overflows. So the assumption here is if a sign integer overflows, it becomes negative, we abort. And let's say size is actually in max, so adding 1 makes it overflow. So what would you think this code prints? Who thinks this prints nothing at all? Okay. Who thinks this prints aborted? Few. Who thinks this prints fetching memory? Okay. And who thinks this prints size? Okay. So, I mean, I sort of gave it away, and in a way, of course, a lot of these questions' answers are obviously not what you expect them to be. There are some coming, fortunately, where they are what you'd expect them to be, so still have to guess it. Indeed, prints fetching memory in this case, which is a similarity to set. And the reason is just that if you optimize this code, what happens is, okay, so the size plus 1 is obviously larger than size, because it's size but incremented by 1. So this whole if statement is optimized away. It just never happens.
Yep.
And why is that? So we broke undefined behavior. If we had an unsigned integer type, overflow is actually well defined. If we have the maximum value for an unsigned integer type, you add 1, it's always 0. That's well defined. If you have a signed integer, not so much, because the overflow is just undefined, that would happen there. in, it doesn't wrap around to the negative value, which was the assumption in the previous slide. And I mean, obviously, the real solution in this case is okay, check it against int max. If it's int max, you can't just add one or cast it to something larger than the type you got as an argument. I think that that will work just fine. Okay, yeah. So this is what I said before again. But I want to talk about this anymore. So the thing is, you can think of this, and this is in a lot of cases useful to think of it as case collapse. So you have multiple cases, yes, the case, and either your behavior is defined, and then size plus one can never overflow, and size plus one is obviously larger than size. Or you have the case your behavior is undefined, size plus one is something, and well, something could be larger than size, and behavior is undefined anyway, so your case collapses to being false too, because undefined or false might as well be false. And if you're an optimizing compiler, you're just going to do that. So this is if false, and the old statements go away. Okay, then there's some undefined behavior you're operating. You might not have known it's a name for it. Obviously, you're referencing a null pointer. You're referencing a wild pointer, which is basically take a number, pass it to a pointer, dereference it. So memory just doesn't belong to you. Read memory or anything like that. And then two high error instances, which basically is, if you think about what that does, a wild pointer, because it just reads past the error you see. But okay, then some mitigation. So we want to avoid that, right? There's some different things you can do. You can use compiler warnings, and obviously just specifying W all helps, and of course we all do that because we like our warnings, and we read them all, and we correct them all. And use W errors so we don't miss any of them, right? So then, if that doesn't help, or if your autocompiler doesn't want, there's something you can do in plan, which is interesting. You have flags called fcatch undefined behavior, fprepv, and what they do is collectively they generate code that's executed at runtime and checks your variables. Like the shift amount might not be the constant we can easily check, this might be a variable which is derived from some user input, so you need to check this at runtime. So this introduces runtime checks, which actually just check, okay, is this larger than 31? If it is larger than 31, it executes a trap, which basically means your program will crash. So it's not ideal. It's, if you have it in a network application, definitely your EOS. But if you use it during debugging, you have a nice advantage, because if your compiler generated code that just worked for your platform, but in fact was undefined behavior, it would suddenly not just work for your platform, but it will crash. You will have a reason to debug this. Similar thing for ftrapv. This is just the same thing, but specifically for signed integer overflow. Introduces this checks basically against int max. Then if you really want to, you can make signed integer overflow wrap. So this is the minus f wrap v flag, which means that yes, int max plus one is in bin, if you tell your compiler so. And then there's some things you just can't do in the compiler, because compilers need to be fast. I mean, they're gentle users. You don't want them to compile up twice as long because you're checking for all the possible warnings and whatnot. And you can do some further analysis in theory if you just look at what you can do with compiler engineering. And there are static analyzers for that, where you really deeply analyze C code. And noticeably, there's the Clang static analyzer, which basically is graphed from the Clang source code and gives you a lot of very interesting graphs. Actually, it can tell you, okay, if you check this four branches in if statements, right? So this is false, this is true, this is false, this is true. Then you might end up with a situation where that variable is in fact too large. So it's a shift amount of 32, something like that. The NSS does that very well and shows you, so you might want to use that on location in the source code. And then if you see that even that can't spot, you have dynamic analyzers which basically create instructions at runtime in your program and check certain conditions. So well-known is Valgrind, mostly as a memory checker, but you also can check for different things, also on the behavior partially. And that's something else to try if you want to do all this. Okay, so So the question again is, would this simple print this time be again optimized? And we're using Clang or GCC, it doesn't really matter. So we have a function, and our function takes two pointers. And we assign both pointers different values, as such fine, and we print the value of, well, the value at the location I points to. And we have our main function, and that creates an integer and calls this function, specifying the same variable twice, or the address of the same variable. So what would you think? I mean, obviously, f is now pointing to the same memory I is pointing to, so it writes routine to the same memory, maybe not. So yeah, who thinks this prints 42? Three, four people. Who thinks this prints 13? One person. Who thinks this prints 0? Also one person, I think. And who thinks this prints large random-ish looking number? Okay, that's all right. So this obviously prints 42. And the reason is quite simple, because this falls into the strict asymptote, which basically just says, okay, if you have a memory that is of type integer, you cannot access it via anything else that's not of type integer. So what this does in fact is, okay, I have an access to a variable I, which means everything that wrote this variable must have had type integer. And there's just one thing that might have wrote this variable that has type integer and that set it 42. So it can be constant propagation. It can just put this 42 immediately here and print that, because f cannot possibly have changed, right? This code will generate a warning, it's FYI. So yeah, long version of that, C allows for ADC. So if you set a pointer to an address of something, you have suddenly an alias. So the dereference of PA, the point in this case, alias is A, it's just the same object. I should probably say object is in terms of what C99 thinks, so this doesn't mean like C++ object or anything, but it's just representation of a variable in memory, it's an object. So since C99, not all expressions may be used to access an object, so this is actually new in C99, and that's not having fun with C99 possible. You really need to pay attention. You cannot just randomly cast things to float pointers and access them and expect that it will just all work. So the expression that you use to access this object in memory must have a matching type. And this is what's called a strict asymptote. It's actually not called that in the standard, interestingly. The standard just has a note sort of next to this rule which says this is meant to restrict aliasing, but all the compilers and pretty much everyone else reference it's a strict asymptote rule. And so, yeah, as I've said, with some syntax at third point, you may not access an integer. So there are some exceptions. You can address that object with a different signs. So if you have an unsigned integer, you may write yours with a signed integer pointer. You can have different qualifiers. So maybe volatile or not volatile. It may be a member of a, well, structured type, so it's a struct array of a union, which makes sense. So if you have an integer member of a struct, you obviously can change an integer if he's changed to the struct. And then you may use character types. And that's actually, well, let's say it's nice of them, because then the standard committee just noticed, okay, a lot of people do byte arithmetic on these things, and they'll access it on a byte granularity, so it's characters. So let's allow that, because it's actually useful. So, as I said, the reason for doing this is that it gives you a lot of potential for constant propagation, which is actually a quite valid optimization, one of the Dragon Book optimizations if you're listening to compiler engineering. And what it basically means is if you assign something to an object and you don't have another assignment to the same object, you can just put the constant if you refer to that object again. So in this case, it basically means, okay, you assign to the file. As you assign to I the value 5, so you can just call g, which is the parameter 5, instead of g referencing I, and then taking that value, just calling g with that. And if you didn't have the strict aliasing, this would be different. If you don't have strict aliasing, that's what it also says in the Blackberry, I think, once you have a address-based write access. So basically, if you write to float, if you write to struct, if you write to anything based on a pointer, after you've assigned something, you have to invalidate all your constants. So you cannot reuse a constant past that point. And what strict aliasing allows you is basically to just have a lot more potential for constant propagation that actually helps. Yes?
Is that true for the source type being void star to, the void pointer?
That's a good question. It doesn't say anything. Well, so basically what the standard says is you may not do this. And in the end, I showed the exceptions. Void pointer is not one of them. I'm not sure what compilers actually do about this. The thing is, you cannot usually write to a void pointer anyway, because how do you assign to a void pointer? What do you cast to before that? The only thing you can do is cast to a void pointer and cast back to something. And once you have done that, you're certainly not following the strict aliasing, because in the end, you have an integer, you cast it to void pointer, you cast it to float pointer, and in the end, you're accessing an integer through float. And that's not following the rule, obviously. So, yes, that sort of applies. Okay, so yeah, if you want to have aliases and you can control that sort of thing, you can put the two alias things in a union. So basically, if you have a floating union, the same union, you can assign to the floating list, and by the rule, no, the integer may change, and vice versa. This is helpful. Sometimes you cannot control that, which is annoying. There are actually some CAPIs out there who make you do strange things. And the real solution to that, if you cannot control how the memory is allocated, is the function does that for you, something you actually need to use MapCouple, which may or not be, may or may not be efficient. Yes?
The last example of the first one would be a human self.
Pardon?
How would the human help you?
Yes, it would. So, yes, that's actually the point. So some people try to avoid this by putting two pointers in the union, which is not following the rule either. You actually need to allocate the objects in that way. So this is one of the cases where, yes, it is not possible. You can allocate a new float and then mem copy from that float to I, but otherwise, that's just not possible. What you can do, what is actually helpful in this case, and we'll get you probably a lot of more compiler warnings too, you can say that these two pointers are what's called restricted. So you can explicitly say these two may not have overlapping memory at all, which is completely different from your question, but still helpful in this case. So nobody would ever pass the same variable twice for both items. Okay. So arrays. Well, let's see if I'm going to point them. So we have a declaration that this is the case where we're expected to get the answer right. And we have the variable A, and it's declared as an array of characters with length 2. And then we have an expression. And the expression is A. And okay, what type does this expression get in the end? Is it an array of character? Do you think so? One person? Is it a character? Nobody? Is it an integer? Okay, I think so. Is it a quantity character? Right, and you probably all knew that or have heard that if you have an expression which is type area of character, it's automatically converted to quantity character. So, the example I hope you'll get wrong, otherwise I might just skip that. So we have a declaration of a variable B, and it's a two-dimensional array in the end. And then again, we have the expression B. And what is that? Is it an array of character? Do you think so? Okay. Is it a pointed to array of character? Is it an array of pointers to character? And is it a pointed to character? Okay, lots. So that's what I was hoping for. So no, this rule I talked about does actually not apply recursively. You just do that once, so you have an object of type. Well, the object is the array of character, and you apply the rule once. So basically, the first array arm in that type expression is changed to pointer to. But you don't do that twice, so you get a pointer to array of character in the end. So yeah, I like that one too. So how do you declare a pointer to an array of integers? And I've tried to ask that people in preparation for this talk and if they think they got zero correct answers. So who thinks it's the first one? Okay, who thinks it's the second option? Three brave persons. Who thinks it's the third option? And who thinks it's a fourth option? One, two, three. Well, that's the first. And there's a rule of thumb here, actually, which is declare it how you use it. So if you have a pointer to an array, what you first do is obviously, because it's a pointer to an array, you first dereference it, and then you use the array. So this is how it's declared, right? You use braces to make sure that the dereference is the first thing, and then you have the array indices. I mean, I'm not sure I should talk about the other ones. The second one is hopefully obvious. That's an array of pointers. Right, if you think about it, that's how you declare it. The third thing is actually an incomplete type, and as such, not a valid declaration. You can, however, use it in function prototypes. And in function prototypes, it's actually the same thing. Because in function prototypes, the first level of array of sort of is automatically converted to pointers. So you could actually put a size in the first brackets or not. It will always be pointed to an array if you use it in a function. And well, the third one is just invalid code as a fourth. So yeah, as I said, generally well understood. And as I hopefully managed to demonstrate, there is sometimes confusion of the arrays into pointers. And this is in full quote the rule I was talking about. So whenever you have an expression that has a type, array of type, or a type, maybe anything, it is converted to an expression whose type pointed to type. And you all got that basically right on the first question, but the thing is this does not apply recursively. So there are two exceptions to this, which are sort of obvious. This does not apply if you give it as a parameter to size of, which makes sense because if that applied, if you give it as a parameter to size of, if you use the size of some array, you would always just get your size of the pointer, which is not what you wanted, right? Which is a good catch, because if you do this in a function, and you get a parameter, and you declare that with those brackets, as I said, this will automatically be converted to a pointer, and you will get into that good function always the size of the pointer, which you might not have expected. And obviously, if you try to get the address of the array, so this is putting salt in zoom. So you often use it. It's basically a car pointer pointer. You know it's a two-dimensional array. And if you write this code which assigns a two-dimensional array to a car pointer pointer, you get a warning from your compiler. And it's a different type. I mean, the first one is pointed to the array of car, well the right end of the assignment. And the left one is pointing to pointer to car, so that's not the same thing. And as I've said, if you actually want to declare that pointer to area of car, this is assigned as left, this is how the declaration is. So, and if I just cast this, somehow people get interesting ideas. So what if I put a cast around this and assign it that way, and the compiler won't give me a warning anymore, that will work, right? No, it will not. Because that's what that looks like memory just to me. If you have a two-dimensional array, everything is just in memory one after the other. That's a large chunk. If you have a pointer to array, you actually have a set of pointers, so it's a right variant, and those pointers point to chunks. And they don't actually have to be right next to each other in memory either. So let's see if you understood this sort of So we still have a two-dimensional object declared. So an array with the size of 3 of arrays with the size of 5. And we have this expression, which is basically put the array name, which is converted to pointer to array of car, and add 1, and the pointer is not there. So if we, well, let's say we put braces around the reference at the sign, how many characters, like how many bytes after the start of the array B will we actually assign? Who thinks it's 1 byte? Okay, who thinks it's 5 byte? Plenty. Who thinks it's 10 byte? And who thinks it's 0 byte? Okay, so as most of you said, 5 byte. And the reason is quite simple, in fact. So as I said, this is a pointer to an array of car. The long version is of that is it's a pointer to an array of size 5 of characters, and each character has the size of 1 byte. So basically, what you shifted by is the size of the second level array. So we shifted by array, so which is 5 bytes long. Okay, let's talk about conversions, and I'll talk about it quickly. So this is, as I said, about conversions which apply if you perform certain operations. And in this case, we have two declarations, one unsigned and one signed integer. Values 1 and minus 1, and we just compare it. So who would say this prints true? Okay, who would say this prints nothing? Who would say this prints false? Who has no opinion at all? well, who would say this prints a mixture? Well, no. So everybody's still pondering, I think, at the answer because we're running out of time. It's false. In this case, because we're in fact doing conversions, and I'll talk about the specific rules this conversion works under later, which basically says that the signed integer is converted to an unsigned integer, which means this is so currently uint max, so we have a very huge number, basically, which is obviously which is larger than U. So S is larger than U, and we get false. Okay, so here we have addition. This time it's not 1 and minus 1, but 1 and minus 2. And we're printing the results. So who would think this prints minus 1? Okay, one person. Who thinks this prints 0? Who thinks this prints, I believe this is u and max plus 1 or something? Okay, a few. And who thinks this prints 1? Okay, so this is in fact minus 1, which is sort of what you expected, right? Minus 2 plus 1 is minus 1. Totally, you that some of the results is what you expect. And this is because the conversions are actually not random. They're chosen in a way that you often get exactly the result that you would expect. And specifically for addition, you pretty much always get the result that you expect. And the reason is basically the way that signed integers are converted to unsigned integers, which is by adding, what is it, I think the maximum number representable by an unsigned integer, and then that plus 1 to the signed integer until it fits into your type. And what that does is basically, if you know that sort of math, you're in a modular ring where everything is considered modulo u in max plus 1. And if you go from that ring back to signed numbers, assuming your result is positive, the result is actually modified, which means that this example is completely wrong. It is, yes. It's just that being should have been 2 and minus 1, I think. And then the result should be 1. Yes, I should explain that because if I ramble on, it doesn't make sense. So what you get in fact a modular ring. Okay, so far so good. So you're calculating unsigned numbers, but the time really is to say some signed number which might be negative. But if you convert from an unsigned integer to a signed integer, and your unsigned integer is actually larger than what your signed integer can represent, we are in the zone of undefined behavior again. It just doesn't work. Or it might actually be implementation defined, but it's not portable as such. If, however, your result fits, so it is, for example, 1, the conversion is well defined. You can certainly cast a unsigned 1 to signed 1 and it can work. So if you're doing this arithmetic and your result is positive, which is where this example is from, casting effect is perfectly fine to get the result you expect. This case actually does work. It is, however, in that case, the implementation defined behavior where you have a very large unsigned number and the implementation somehow converts it back to a signed integer, and most compilers do this correctly in the way that you get the -1 in this case. Okay, so how do these conversions work? There is a lot of theory behind this actually in the C standard if you look at it. And the first thing is integer conversion ranks, which are basically, it's a, well, rank. Let's say it's a number assigned to each integer type. And it's used to determine which integer type you need to convert to. And there's no fixed mapping. This is so the mapping is completely implementation defined. However, there are rules by which to do this mapping. And the rough rule, and there's a whole set of them, but you don't really need to remember them. But just remember a larger range of values which can be stored in the variable equals a higher rank. And that's pretty much always the case. I've not found anything where the rule would break that. Also note, larger range means if you have something negative to something positive, that's the range. You don't go from 0 to highest positive value. So an unsigned integer and a signed integer do have the same range in terms of how big it is. It can represent the same amount of numbers. They're just at an offset. So they get the same conversion mechanism. So then there are integer conversions. And those are applied only if the type of the expression is of a lower rank than unsigned integer, so character or short usually. And they're all converted to an int if your expression is representable by an integer. Otherwise, they're converted to an unsigned integer. And since the rank was lower, so the amount of values representable was smaller, this will always work. So when does it happen? That happens as part of the usual arithmetic conversions, and we'll see those later. Also default argument promotions. And then whenever you use the unary plus, minus, or not operators, where unary means if you just want -1, not as a subtraction, just unary from what you have. And there's also a plus like that and negate bitwise negation action there. And then to both operands of the shift operators, for whatever reason. So you basically, if you have that shift 1 to the right by 32, both the 1 as well as the 32 are first cast up to an integer, which can give you unexpected results if you were performing arithmetic on the character, because suddenly you would have expected that, well, you might have expected you to identify behavior because you shifted the character by 9, and suddenly it was an integer. So 9 is well the range of an integer because that's usually 16 or 32-bit, 16 if you were in the so we call argument promotions. Say we have a function, and say we don't know the types of the parameters. So you don't have a prototype, which you can do in C. Nobody does that, luckily, but you can do that. Also, if you have variadic functions, so something like printf, where you just can put any number of parameters at the end, you don't have a type for these parameters. And you need some rule what type to convert them to. And first, you do the integer promotions, which we have just seen. So everything smaller than an integer is basically cast up to an integer. And all floats are converted to doubles, which you may or may not have noticed that printf and printf is actually the formal specifier for double. Even though it sounds too much like float, but you can use it for both a float and a double just because of this conversion. additional operation, but in that case, just to second and third argument. So what do they do? They do a lot of stuff, and I'm not going to go over this in detail, but I'm going to encourage you to look it up. So basically, if one thing is not double, the other thing, so you have two outputs, two classes, right? So if one of them is lung double, the other one also gets cast to lung double. If one is double, the other one also gets cast to double. If one is float, the other one also gets cast to float. So you go through the set of rules. And there are final ones. So at that point, if you're not finished, you do integer promotions, and then you look whether they have the same signs or not. As I said, I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to go over this into detail. It's lengthy and complicated rules, but I encourage you to look them up, especially if you're not sure about what the expression actually does, since you're adding sort of lots of integer types with different sizes. So this is basically the example I've previously had as a question. So A and B have the same rank, as I said, unsigned and signed integer can represent the same amount of values, not the same values, but the same amount. And since they have the same rank, in this case, they fall through all of those rules that I've just seen, and are both converted to non-signed integer. For both of these operations, the rules are exactly the same. And as we've seen, this means A, if A is larger than B, is false. But plus works just nicely. And in this case, it's a zero, so as I said, positive values and or zero will work fine. So, problems 299. So first thing I wanted to show you, compound integers. Who has actually heard of compound integers before? Nobody, at least not another name. So they look like casting an initializer. And if you show that to something and say, have you seen that? They'll always say, of course. I use that all the time. And then you tell them what it is and they say, whoa, what's that? I've never seen that. So in the end, it's really an anonymous object in C. And what it does in this case is you have an object, which is of type array 3 of integer, and it's initialized with these values. And you don't need to do the assignment. This is not a way of initializing this, well, it's not even right to initialize this pointer. It's a way of creating an anonymous object of type array of int. And what happens then is this anonymous object, because it's type array of int, the expression is converted to pointer to integer, and you can assign it to a pointer to integer. And you never actually created sort of an array, you just had this anonymous object and assign it to a pointer. And I have no idea why. For some reason they just had, okay, we could make this a null value, so that you can assign data to anonymous objects and never get back to it. For no apparent reason. But I think they're kind of cool. You can basically, I mean, the main usage for them is get around declaring a value, which is basically just, I want to get memory, and then we'll always just use it as a pointer. You can instead create an anonymous object, assign it to a pointer, and you have it, with only declaring one instead of two variables, which is sort of neat. And then there are booleans in C99. They actually use C have booleans. Okay, no fingers in it. So there's a real boolean type. It has the somewhat unfancy fancy name, underline bool, which is in uppercase B2. Luckily, there is a header for that, and that's also standard. It's called std bool.h. And what it basically does, it gives you a type def, which is then called bool. So you can declare a boolean as bool. Just like in C++, and they just say this is for C++ compatibility. And gives you the usual constants true and false, which you also normally would have in C. Okay, so I think I'm pretty much out of time, so thank you for your attention. It's been great honors. And I would take questions until somebody completely stops me. About 1 or 2 minutes, I guess. If there are any.
Thank you.
That's a very good question. I probably have to reread the rules. They allow for lots of stuff. They also allow for a number of instances ever. They allow for sine magnitude. So that's valid. You can represent instances whatever you want to. And you're probably right that yes, that would have one value less in that case if you use one's complement. And sure, you're probably right that things they might still end up with the same rank, they might actually end up with different ranks. But let's get away with it. This doesn't happen in practice. Because pretty much everyone uses two's complement because your hardware does that. So yeah. But it's a good question. Feel free to read up on that.